Okay, this is session number 54, recorded on February 11th, 2008, and this is Side A. And we're working on the computer and atom bomb section, computer and atom bomb, the category underneath ALP, the bottom-up ground effects preceding causes section. So we're talking about Shem as the automobile, Sean as the quark tune, which means cartoon slash quark, and Issy is Kennedy, which is the sociological, psychological mask leg, and the period is 1918-1945. So you have the computer and the atom bomb being built by 1945. The research before that leads to the culmination of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 for the atom bomb, and the computer was rudimentarily being used. IBM got the Nazis to use the IBM system to monitor the concentration camps. And so, with Kennedy as the peak of the Cold War...
Monitor the concentration camps?
Yeah, IBM, their classification database and technology, they tested it in the concentration camps.
Remember that movie Spielberg did where he was about the guy who was managing the concentration camps and he was smuggling Jews out?
Right.
They didn't show any computer technology in that film, did they?
No. Anyways, the thing is, you have Kennedy representing the cultural lag. So the effects of the atom bomb, which led to the Cold War, or was a major stick and image in the Cold War, it peaks in the time of Kennedy, 1960. That's when Khrushchev is visiting the United States and appearing in the United Nations and banging his shoe on the desk. That was the cliche peak of the Cold War. And so Kennedy was supposedly working with Pope John the 23rd. Yeah, John Paul the 23rd. Pope John the 23rd, whatever the guy was in the early 60s. And Khrushchev and John Paul, no, John, Pope John the 23rd, and Kennedy were having secret talks about figuring out how to get past the Cold War. So the computer is a technology that could organize a world government. And so the battle for the position in the secret HCE level, the right-hand column, the control of the world that was the issue in World War II when the computer and the atom bomb were the hidden ground, by 1960, that bureaucratic control of the world is obsolete. And Kennedy acts out that battle from the 30s and 40s, all right? He's a lag image, cultural lag, all right? And part of his image involves Shem and Sean, his kids, which is the automobile and the quark tune, Disney and the Rat Pack.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're doing is locking down the other half of the world government, which would be Soviet Union and China, mainly Asia. So you have... the problems for the French colonializers in Vietnam, which are inherited by the Americans in the early 60s. So that period is the consolidation of the global world government in Asia, all right, the other half of the world.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Oh, okay. And so when you mean the other half of the world government, I thought you meant a completion of the lockdown of the first half. I didn't think you literally meant the other side of the globe.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The first half is earlier. The position to lock down the Asian part. I mean, remember, the war is fought in the Pacific against Japan. That's a major Pacific front. The lockdown of World War One, which was the first half of the world government, that is brought in with the League of Nations. At the end of World War II, you have the United Nations, and it includes the occupation of Japan, and Chiang Kai-shek is propped up in China against the communists. Mao Zedong is still out in the wilderness. The bureaucratic control of the whole planet by the HCE forces is established on the second level, the other half. It's being fought over as a hidden ground in World War II, and then it's implemented after World War II, bureaucratically.
Are the HCE forces unified at this level, or do they have opposition?
Well, they always have opposition. There's always factions. The actual factions are the Jesuits and the Nazis and the Bolsheviks, the Freemasons, and the Mossad, or Israel, the Zionists, if you want to say.
Those are all factions in addition to HCE.
They are the parts of HCE.
Oh.
HCE is the intelligence agency.
Yeah, but they're not all collaborating.
Oh, yeah, they collaborate and conflict. Endless battles, they're still doing it. So the world is a small place by 1945. So the historical groups that were part of the locking down of the world government are now jockeying like 10 little Indians. And, you know, that musical chairs thing, I think it's 10 little Indians are sitting there, and then there was 9 little Indians, and then 8, then 7, and 6. Well, like a musical chairs, each chair keeps getting removed. You could say there were 10 musical chairs in 1750. By 1945, there's one chair. So which faction is going to occupy that chair? On the national level, it was the United States. They won World War II with the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
So the hidden ground of
World War... Who were the Japanese allied with in World War II?
Who were they allied with?
Yeah.
Italy and Nazi Germany. The fascists.
Oh, okay.
Fascists and Nazis. So the thing is that you have the hidden tool for locking down
the
other
Europeans
half.
Were fascist. The United States was a fascist, was developing.
Italy was fascist, technically. The Germans were Nazis. And the Japanese were considered fascists. They weren't Nazis.
But how did that conflict with U.S. interests?
The U.S. were Democrats. Democratic.
On the surface, I guess.
Yeah, well, you're talking from the perspective now. You've been had many layers of illusion peeled off over the last 50 years in different technological environments. So you thought the Americans were fascist?
Well, fascism seemed to start invading this and other countries after World War II.
Yeah, but we're talking about up to World War II. Now, the legacy of these factions is incarnated in Kennedy. Kennedy has to juggle all these groups, including the mafia. And so he gets caught in the crossfire eventually, right?
Mm-hmm.
He angers too many factions. But his father was the head of the mafia, and the mafia worked with the fascists in the 50s, so... You know, you could say America was fascist at that point under Kennedy, but you get a lot of argument, which would obscure the issue that, and the issue is that the hidden ground of World War II was the computer and the atom bomb, and all of a sudden the ground became figure. And on August 6, 1945, let's say on August 7th, they saw the newspaper image of the bomb going off. They go, "What the heck is that?" Remember, people didn't even know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
It's top secret. So the power that comes with the computer and the atom bomb is epitomized politically by Kennedy in 1960. But what's sneaking up underneath Kennedy is the next environment, satellite and laser beam. Laser beam is invented in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see the category there on the satellite and laser beam level is lockdown solar government. We're now off the planet. So Kennedy represents the popular move towards some kind of universal, it was called peaceful coexistence back then, between the Soviets and the American empires. Peaceful coexistence. If we could have that, then it's a nice, happy planet. And so that was what was the motive towards official bureaucratic world government.
Well, when computer and atom bomb were hidden ground, were they having very similar effects or very different effects?
They haven't arrived yet. They It's what HDD.
No, but their effects were being broadcast.
No, the effects don't show up until Kennedy. The hidden ground of the HCE intelligence agencies are fighting over creating the atomic bomb. The big secret. I mean, you have famous German physicists conscience-stricken over whether they should help Hitler have the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And Oppenheimer and his team in the United States are trying to invent the bomb themselves. That was the real battle in World War II that the intelligence agencies were involved in.
Mm.
You know, the secret projects like Chalk River and the Manhattan Project. These things, the average citizen who's fighting a war, you could say, over the automobile versus the Hollywood image. That's partly what people think about World War II. When you think of movie images of World War II, there's the plane attacking cities, and you also see Nazi generals driving around in their vehicles.
Tanks.
Think of that cliche image, right?
Yeah.
Don't you think, when you think of Nazis, besides the robot guy saluting his superiors, you think of him rushing around Germany or Europe in his Jeep or something.
Or a tank, yeah.
Yeah. That's the automobile versus the cartoon image. It's the beginning of the cartoon image, the way it's presented in World War II.
Mm.
So that's what the people were involved in, terrestrial occupying and taking over territory, where the real thing was, if you had the atomic bomb, you didn't have to occupy any territory. You just threaten anybody. The beginning of a disembodied state of control.
Well, how early on did they conceptualize the idea of building the bomb?
About 1932 is when they discovered the neutron, I think. And then by the late 30s, as Hitler's looking to be a world power, Einstein gets in touch with Roosevelt and says, I think we got a problem here because it's potentially the unleashing of atomic power. So in the 30s, the avant-garde scientists were beginning to see the potential of atomic energy,
mm-hmm.
harnessing the neutron, the electron, and... So they realized, there's a famous letter of Einstein warning Roosevelt, uh-oh, I think it's like he could see the hidden ground. He says, if the Nazis take over, we're in trouble. And they could take over if they get a gigantic bomb.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's what the intelligence agencies monitoring what the scientists were doing were aware of. Said, geez, we got some new ultimate weapon happening here.
Right.
And so that was the secret part of World War II.
So HCE is always aware.
Intelligence.
Yeah,
the avant-garde intelligence agencies.
Right. They're always aware of what's going on in the ALP stage.
Right, and they're looking at it bureaucratically. They are looking at the effects merging with the causes, not the effects preceding the causes. They're looking at what are the effects of this new technology or causes on our bureaucratic control.
Mm-hmm. Potentially, since these effects are preceding the causes in the ALP stage, there's still potential, but the effects are preceding the causes.
But look how it's written. Under HCE, I've got causes in quotes, merging with effects, right?
Mm-hmm.
But under ALP, causes is not in quotes. Effects preceding causes means the actual causes, the actual unforeseen causes. And the effects that the causes are going to bring in are already manifesting.
Mm-hmm.
So that 1918 to 1945 is a collective effect by the non-existing computer and atom bomb. But scientists is unwittingly working towards inventing those things and doesn't even know it yet.
Right, so they're already having to plan for what's going to happen when they are made manifest.
Right. So but what they do is they don't see the real causes. They don't know they're going to have a bomb or what it's actually going to be or a computer. They're just making discoveries that will actually become different parts that fit in and make a coherent invention once that invention is arrived at. Up to that point...
Well, so in 1918, the idea of the atomic bomb was just some kind of a weird intuition that was... subconscious.
That's science fiction. My H.G. Wells, I don't know when he starts writing about it. I mean, 1932 is Brave New World. Huxley is talking about drugs, but he might have talked about a bomb. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Orwell talks about bombs in 1948 in his book 1984.
Well, by 1930, as you were pointing out, by 1932, they were already beginning to plan the development of them. So at that point, they also had to think about what the effects would be when, you know, at that point it was already concrete. It was like it's on the drawing board.
Okay. Now look, this is why we're trying to get to explain why causes is in quotes. The effects preceding causes, nobody is seeing that.
No, so not by 1918, but by 1935 they are, and by 1945 it's exploded.
Well, you tell me what I mean by causes, in quotes, if you're not going to let me explain it.
Well, no, go ahead.
Yeah,
Why
is it? No, you tell me why causes in quotes under HCE.
That means that you're not supposed to take that literally. There's more to the story.
No, it means that the HCE bureaucratic power intelligence agencies think they're defending certain structures. They have their causes. Back then, it was called communist versus capitalist,
mm-hmm.
or fascist versus Democrats.
Mm.
Those are the causes that intelligence agencies think they're defending. You could even say Christianity versus atheism. They are not the causes. What their bureaucratic efforts to preserve are, and what they think new technology will do to those bureaucratic causes or structures, is not the real causes,
no.
which will lead to bigger effects than they anticipate.
Yeah, but let me just say here, in 1918, the atomic bomb was science fiction, so they probably weren't too worried about it. By 1932, when scientists are actually working on the development of it, it's something they do have to be concerned about, so it becomes a real cause.
Right, and probably not in 32, probably a few years later, when they had to, when they started to see the implications of the neutron, because when they discover whatever they discovered in 32, which I think was the neutron, that they have to think about that for a few years. They don't even know what they've discovered, what it means. It's not till the late 30s that the idea of the atomic bomb is coming up. But that's in the period 18 to 45. And I'm saying that the collective mind is working out new environments unwittingly. They don't even know what's happening. Because when you get the computer and the atom bomb here, what's that going to lead to? Well, it does lead to a situation after World War II where former allies, the Soviet Union and the West, the Democratic West, become enemies. Because now the world's so tiny, the atom bomb is the key to who controls it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the hidden effect of the computer and the atom bomb was whoever won the war would end up having a split within the different countries or intelligence factions. So they couldn't have a unified victory.
Mm-hmm.
Because the atom bomb meant total control. Now, who expected total control? On that level.
Right.
I mean, in the 30s, the Americans might have thought of, or the Nazis, whoever, thought if we win this war, then we'll be able to coordinate and rule the different bureaucratic parts of the world. But we had a bureaucratic image. Like
or cause them all to conform to our bureaucracy.
Yeah, a conformity. And like McLuhan said, every war is fought with the tools of today to preserve the jobs of yesterday. Mm. So the Nazis were trying to take over the world and implement a bureaucratic control along 19th century lines with the latest tools. They didn't know the latest tools would alter the stakes or alter the situation, because the computer and the atom bomb are going to cause incredible decentralization.
Yeah, and that creates a different...
Right.
That promotes a different ideology.
Right. The computer and the atom bomb are going to be fit into the medium, and the medium is the previous environments. So you're going to fit the computer and atom bomb into the TV effects and the radio effects and the movie effects before that,
mm-hmm.
which you've already set up weird post-litter decentralized structures.
Well, how do the TV effects, how are TV effects mutated by the effects of the computer and atom bomb fitting into the TV effects?
What happened in the mid-60s, they killed live TV. Once TV was no longer the environment the computer and the atom bomb were, then TV no longer was live.
What's that got to do with the computer and the atom bomb?
The atom bomb is a new environment. That becomes the managed issue of how to organize previous environments. So television and radio became automated. It was the top 40 hit parade list. That's what Zappa rebelled against in his Absolutely Free album with the slogan Kill Ugly Radio. It was in 65, 66 that top 40 radio took over. They started programming the content of teen radio according to computerized lists.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that they felt threatened by live TV and were making a conscious decision to turn off live TV. It's just that the computer made it more efficient to program it and turn it into an automated.
Right. McLuhan called it the two-bit wit, the off and on, the digital, you could say. The two-bit wit of the computer turned TV into a programmed environment. Mm-hmm. So an automatic environment. It was already programmed when it was live, but not to the extent, as I'm going to say, if one wants to listen to my dialogue with Scott in the McLuhan Way thing we did in Bob Tor 07, we talked about how we cited the McLuhan quote where he said that the car and the oil crisis were linked because the television made the car obsolete. So therefore, the car was not the hidden ground anymore, and TV was. So the feeling for the car changed, and therefore you had the rising inflation of oil prices and the idea that we were running out of oil. It was not something protected as much. It wasn't a hidden ground. Now, you'd have to read the quote to get what I'm saying because it's a complex quote. Remember we discussed that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. But the point is that the his main statement, which is on 241 of the book Understanding Me, lectures by McLuhan, put out by his daughter, he says technology does not change the world. The medium that the technology affects changes the world. Or the medium is what's caused by the technology. Remember that?
The medium is the technology. How do you separate the two?
The TV is, did you say?
No, I said the medium is technology. How do you separate the two?
No, the medium is the older technology and all the services and disservices that came in with the older technology.
Mm-hmm.
The medium is the past.
Yeah.
Technology. But when a new technology comes in, it doesn't change the world. The medium that it's interacting with is changed and causes the changes because the TV brings in other new services and disservices, new side industries that are the actual medium of the TV. The TV, he said, would just be the figure.
Yeah.
Whereas the ground is the medium or the actual extra stuff that television requires for it to be a service.
Oh, yeah.
So for the car, he said the medium was the gas stations and the oil companies and the international oil shipping environment.
Right.
That was the medium.
Right. But I don't see why you need the computer to turn the TV into a programmed environment, because all you really need to do is to film stuff and then to say, okay, well, we're going to put this film on at 8 o'clock and we're going to put this TV show on at 6 o'clock and we're going to put this movie on at 12 o'clock, you're programming it. Well, you don't need a computer to do that. The very fact that you've recorded something and you can play it back, which was an important point that McLuhan made in that recent post you made where he was talking to the priest about
the instant replay.
He wasn't talking about the instant replay. He was just talking about the ability to replay any event. I don't know if we got to the instant replay by that point, but the very fact of able...
That interview was done in 75.
But even apart from the instant replay, the ability to record any event and then play it back at a later date, you can do that with TV.
You're missing the point here where you're talking about how could computer change TV? Well, you're thinking the computer is the technology to change the TV. No, the computer creates a global economy. It creates all kinds of problems in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It moves the economy into non-fixed rates. Okay?
Yeah. Non-fixed rates?
Non-fixed rates of exchange.
What does that mean?
It means the dollar is not the standard and gold is not the standard. They become floating ratios with other currencies. You don't have fixed exchange rates between currencies. So the floating world, the virtual financial economy that the computer brings in, affects TV. In other words, the side effects of the computer, not the computer itself, but the new services and effects on older media that computer brings in, affects an older medium, the TV world.
Yeah.
The TV has to speed up, and it's more expensive, and all these other problems affect the TV industry caused by the new extensions of the computer medium.
So, see, it's easy to see how movies become content for TV, but when we talk about the computer and the atom bomb, the computer and the atom bomb don't become content for TV in the same way. They just create a whole new environment, which then mutates the TV environment.
Okay, the reason, the way TV became the content of computers, that's the Kennedy Revolution, the Camelot. Kennedy is a charismatic image.
No, you said that backwards. You said TV became content for computers.
Yeah, TV is the content for the new environment, the computers. All right?
So yeah.
The computer medium makes TV the content, and therefore the computer era, the fight over the atomic bomb, 1845, becomes a figure. We have the Cold War. And the figure for that is a charismatic Tom Sawyer image named President Kennedy, who is becoming powerful as a global image beyond the bureaucratic HE machinations, so they get threatened and off them. But the thing is that television and its issues become the content of the computer effect, and therefore everybody thinks it's a TV era.
When I think of the content of the Cold War, I think of 50,000 nuclear warheads pointed at each other from east to west.
Cartoon. There's your cartoon. That's your TV statistic, your TV cartoon image. It's a time of iconography of national statistics and gross national product and your the number of weapons. That's what the Soviets and the Americans would parade it back and forth to each other through news imagery. But the real thing is that we're not even in a battle between nations. You're in the locking down and the externalization of that of the other half of the world government, aligned with the previous half. So you're having world government by 1950s, technically. That means the KGB and the CIA are exchanging, people find this out later in the 80s, are, anyways, back then, HCE is exchanging information between the different factions. KGB knows where the station chiefs are, and the CIA knows where the KGB people are. So secretly, there's a world government in operation. But now, that's in 1960.
There's nobody, there's no one person calling the shots. They're just cooperating with each other out of necessity.
No, there is people, there's a small group known as the Rockefellers, which includes the Morgan interests. They were able to call the shots. That's your Big Brother effect becoming cliche by the 50s, by 1960. Okay? But very quickly, there's a new problem coming up. Because what's happening in 1960 is satellite and laser beam, Sputnik. Here is the Americans winning World War II, and 10, 12 years later, they feel the Russians have moved ahead. The Soviets have moved ahead with Sputnik.
Now, I actually heard someone talking about, they were talking about the history of rocketry, and they were talking about what a... that the effects of Sputnik were way bigger than the actuality of the technology. So all Sputnik did was it sent like a ping like a radio station. It sent like a, you know, it said, you know, ping, I'm here, ping, I'm here, ping, I'm here. It was just radio, two radios talking to each other, one terrestrial and one in orbit. But there was no spying going. The thing had no capacity to do any spying whatsoever. But it created the effect that we were all being watched by something in the sky, which freaked people out. But it actually didn't have any of that technology built into it at all.
Right. So the projection by a visual culture of the eye looking at itself and not aware of the echoing acoustic nature of it, the ping, shows you the Western's paranoia, the visual bias of something that was having way bigger effects than anybody could measure. And one of the effects was this paranoia. And also, the Americans felt like they were inferior. So they changed their educational curricula for kids in schools. They went to war.
Mm-hmm.
It was like in the new stimulus to the early 50s Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
So the satellite affected the older media. That's where the real change will happen.
Oh, yeah.
And a new medium will always create a sense of a threat to one's image, and therefore you'll want to recover your image, and that means war. So what happened is it became a crash program of cultural education in the West.
Mm-hmm.
They revamped the curriculum and emphasized science for the baby boomer kids. And you can go back and see a lot of the humanists felt threatened by this because the English and the bird courses, the book courses, were kind of put on the shelf, sideline.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan wrestled with that issue all the way through that period because he's speaking as an English professor.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to adapt media studies to English and make it a science to counter the, quote, efficient causality kind of science that the Sputnik inspired.
Mm-hmm.
In the American curriculum.
Yeah.
So the point is that to get these relationships, you move to the next one, satellite and laser beam. And it's 45 to 60, secretly locking down the solar government. So while Kennedy is representing a triumphant image in the Cold War for locking down the second half of the world government, which would be Asia and Japan and the Soviet Union, what's really going on is a battle for the solar government. Because that lockdown is happening 45 to 60. And what is the popular image of that sort of battle is Nixon in 1968. And what is Nixon against? Or what is his image problem? He's coming in as president. He's trying to improve his TV image from the early 60s. And once he gets into his administration, he starts bombing Laos and Cambodia. So he's using the old technology of the television and the airplane to fight and actually be a rearview mirror and to disguise the locking down of solar government, which is implemented by satellite and laser beam. All right?
He's using the old technology of the TV, the airplane, and the bomb.
Right. He came in 1968... talking about a different Nixon image. He was advocating participatory democracy, but because television demanded that situation. Kennedy has shown the power of TV, so the Republicans said, well, we got to have a populist kind of veneer for Nixon, who's actually working with mafia guys, because that's the key period for the mafia, their most powerful point in American culture. So here's this mafia guy advertising participatory democracy and actually going to implement an escalation of Vietnam with the airplane. So his image represents the Shem and Sean of TV and airplane as cultural enemy and weaponry. In his administration, he had a problem with his TV image.
Yeah.
So the yippies were able to counter that with their hijinks using...
He had a hot image and a cool medium.
Right. And so he responded with the airplane. And I think the book, the first awareness, popular awareness of advertising taking over, the advertising agencies taking over the presidential race, comes in 1968. And the book is called The Making or the Selling of the President. And it's a book on the 1968 election, how really imagery took over.
In other words, the president's a managed image.
Yeah. It really comes in with Nixon because he's nowhere near the managed image, but the managed image worked. And that means that television is something that's become the heart and soul of the electoral process because Kennedy used it, but it was new when Kennedy was doing it, and he became a threat. But by 68, you get a hot image on there. The president isn't a threat. It actually looks like a weakened institution. So Nixon actually works for the solar government, or unconsciously is an image distracting people from the locking down of the solar government. which is what I was involved in. And what was that? That was just a few telephone numbers and monitoring the developments in the laboratories. Because by then, the meaning was the message was obvious.
What do you mean a few telephone? What's that got to do with satellites and laser beams?
The solar government is just a network of people with the most advanced information on what's going on.
Because they have the capability to spy from outer space?
No, that is a factor, but they go around and investigate the latest labs, the latest developments.
The
hidden ground.
Kind of like Men in Black?
Yeah, that's a popular image of that. They certainly don't look like the Men in Black. I mean, the Men in Black is a big after image by the world government structure to pretend that there's somebody in control on a world level.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they just did that in Stephenville. They sent around some Men in Black. That's just to scare the locals.
Yeah.
But the actual solar government would show up in a sneakers and a tennis racket and a T-shirt and want to play a game with you.
Orchestrated by what organization?
The Secret Council 10, you know, was the solar government.
Mm.
The Men in Black are a subset of
that. That's multinational cooperation.
I would call it multimedia cooperation. The world government manages multinational interplay. But those world bureaucracies are irrelevant when you get to solar government level.
Well, you still have corporate interests within different nationalities. I mean, you got
right.
Prince Charles, and you got, your family.
Just hold that thought. What do you mean by corporate interests? You've got corporate interests are environments that have already been made and became used by masses of people, and those are environments. Okay, the automobile, the television industry, Hollywood, oil, all those corporate things. But there's new technologies being made in the lab. So the solar government does not relate multinational concerns or work in the interval. It works with multi-labs. In other words, what is the next thing being made?
Yeah, but the chemical body human beings that are taking an interest in and doing the orders, like in the past I've heard you drop names like Prince Charles, Turnin Taxis, these are figures representing different national interests.
No, not national, visual space. They represent economic trust funds.
Mm.
That's 300, 400 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The medium of money and gold and credit. That goes back for 500 years. That's what they represent. That's the Gutenberg phase.
They have no interest in propping up their local national image?
No. They operate. They never did. They knew that they found out that the printing press created national images, and they would profit on the wars between the nations that were created by the printing press.
Mm-hmm.
But by that time, by the 60s, the solar government understood the medium was the message. I mean, they knew it in the 50s, and they didn't like McLuhan exposing it. But they really understood how this was the fact that intelligence agencies should concentrate on, especially the solar government. And so they orchestrated labs.
Yeah, but don't you still have deep racial memories which create conflicts among people that are running these different organizations? You still have teams. You still have people that want my team to win, and to whatever degree I can manipulate this game is to the degree to which my side wins.
That's the way it was in the 19th century. As you get into the 20th century, it doesn't matter what race you are to enjoy the products of the wealth and abundance that's created in the 20th century. So remember, the solar government doesn't have to do much. They just make sure that they don't get toppled on the wealth level, which the races don't even know about. The races and tribes are involved in their own identity problems. We don't control that. We do watch the problems that new media create for those traditional ancient battles. But the solar government represents individual literate-based integrity. In other words, it's a product of the Gutenberg era, the idea that I'm an individual and I own this. That ownership principle comes out of the printing press, and that's what the Secret Council 10 individuals represent. And that's why it's a fondy. It's a nest egg. It represents property.
Well, this is, you know, still something that still kind of confuses me. It's like I don't understand how if the Japanese and Italy as allies won World War II, I can't somehow picture the Japanese.
They didn't win war. Where did you?
I'm just saying, if they, let's say they did, since they were,
oh, the Japanese, were, not the Allies, but if the Japanese and German Nazis won World War II.
Yeah, I can't imagine the Japanese and the German Nazis sharing the world together. They seem too. Their identities are so conflicted and so different. I can't imagine them like putting their arms around each other and going, "Okay, we're all going to live happily ever after."
Well, that's what the radio environment did to them. Remember, it was the inferior, less industrialized parts of the world, like Germany. Germany was industrialized in the 19th century, but it got weakened after World War I because it lost the war. So you have Germany deflated in an industrial sense, yet Italy wasn't that developed, and Japan wasn't that developed. They were all inflated by the tribal effect of radio,
yeah,
making them feel more proud than the other tribe. So, yeah, that was the problem.
Just as if they were allies and they won, did they really think they were going to share the spoils?
Under radio conditions, they wouldn't have.
Uh-huh.
The TV came in, and actually the fascist demeanor would have been obsolete under TV conditions. You couldn't have such a hot, ranting guy like Hitler once you had TV.
Yeah.
But
I'll just go off topic a little bit to see what you have to say about this. I never really understand how Japan became so powerful that they thought that they could attack the United States to begin with. You look at them on a map, Japan's not that big. How did they develop the military might that they thought they could challenge the Western world?
Because they felt the acoustic environment resonated with their tribal background. So McLuhan writes about how tribal cultures felt superior when radio came in, and the Western literary cultures felt deflated. As a matter of fact, the collapse of the economy in 1929 was the collapse of visual measuring of the wealth of an information environment caused by radio, and so the Western impulse was to sort of drop the individualist mythos that had been living under for hundreds of years with the Gutenberg effect and start moving, becoming more tribal. So they called it the New Deal. And they called it social democracy in Britain. They called it fascism in Germany and communism in Russia. The thing is, or in the Soviet Union, got to make a distinction, right, between Russia and the Soviet Union. But the point is that the deflation of the Western literate ego by radio caused such a crisis that they couldn't re-energize the economy until Roosevelt brought in the New Deal, and there were very wealthy people in the United States who tried to have a coup against them.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a crisis in the West under the literate West under the tribal effect of radio. In the 30s, what's rising? It's Nazi Germany. Hitler's very popular. He looks very charismatic, and a lot of Western multimillionaires invested in him,
mm-hmm.
like President Bush's grandfather. So the definitely radio. You can that explains why a little nowhere place like Japan felt superior, because they were being inflated, because they had the oral tactile culture of their legacy, of their traditional sensibility. It resonated well with radio.
Yeah.
Whereas the literate guy felt in trouble. I mean, that's where you get the crisis of writing and books, acted out by Wyndham Lewis, Joyce, Pound, and Eliot.
But on the ideological level,
they were called the lost generation.
Yeah.
Hemingway and those guys. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, just on the at the level of ideology, I'm looking at the Ken Burns series that he did on World War II, and he, you know, goes into the sacrifices that infantrymen and Air Force pilots and so on made as they invaded Japan and Europe, and the tremendous sacrifices and suffering that these guys and huge. You know, going into really bad situations against all odds, and in their hearts believing that they had, you'd say to them, you know, was it worth it? And they said, well, we had to do it. We had to do it. They were protecting something ideologically,
yeah,
or a way of life. There was something very important there, and it didn't have anything to do with the radio.
Let's stop there. It had everything to do with radio threatened the American way of life. Because radio was making these tribal cultures feel superior. And they started attacking the rest of the world and wanted to take over in fantasy for the radio effect.
Mm.
That's exactly what they're defending.
Yeah.
They did, and of course they didn't know fully the implications how they were being changed as they fought against their enemy.
Yeah.
By the 50s, they became the most communist country in the world. The United States became.
Yeah.
The collective industry.
Yeah.
And multimedia. So you can carry on with what you were going to say.
But not bureaucratically communistic. So, yeah, I think you have to make a distinction when you use the word communism.
Bureaucracy is literate and industrial. Radio bypasses bureaucracy. The telephone bypasses bureaucracy, and you create your own little mafias, your own little groups. That's what happened in the Nazi Party. Goering, Goebbels, and Hitler, they all had their little separate factions.
Mm-hmm.
And fought for turf within that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's movies made on the massacre of certain parts of the German army by the SS in, I'd say, the late 30s.
Yeah.
I think the movie's called The Damned. Mm-hmm. Look at that. That goes into it.
Mm-hmm.
The factional fighting and the problem for the industrialists of Germany, the millionaires, they didn't know which faction to go with.
Mm-hmm.
So The Damned is a good portrayal of that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But this is an example of effects happening beyond the bureaucratic visions of control. So
yeah.
The Americans fought for their cause. The cause, in quotes, for the Americans was to preserve their way of life against the collectivizing effect of the radio that made less industrialized cultures feel superior. That was their cause. That's cause in quotes. They didn't know that there were larger effects and causes that confused the whole issue. So by the 1970s, or let's say 1980, Germany and Japan are now winning the economic war because they got the car, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mercedes-Benz and the Toyota. I mean, you've heard the joke in the 80s. Geez, the two countries that we beat are now more powerful than us because there were other levels of technological evolution that were overriding the causes in quotes, that World War II was fought over.
Right. So then getting back to the laboratories in 1945
right, so
to 60.
It's a global building.
Now, there are laboratories set up all over the world. You have German labs and European labs and American scientists in their laboratories. What faction has the power to infiltrate all of these labs, like everybody's saying, the French, the German, the Italians, the U.S. scientists, everybody, Japanese, everybody's saying, oh, yeah, come on. It's you. Come on in. See, you can inventory our laboratory. We know who you are. Who? What possible factions of human beings have the carte blanche to walk into anybody's laboratory around the world and assess what's going on?
The wealthiest factions.
Yeah, but an arrogant, you know, from the point of view of a Japanese guy, a laboratory, you know, these American scientists are coming into our lab? I don't think so. That's just basic ego. I mean,
yes, but what happens if you have a Chinese guy going into the Chinese lab and they think you represent some Chinese bureaucracy?
Oh.
It may not be.
Oh,
that
see.
Double, triple disguise is going on.
Yeah. So he may be working for a larger international agency.
That's right. And he wouldn't even know he's working for the solar government. He's working for some international. He could be an American Chinese who smuggled in and disguised as a local Chinese peasant.
Oh, well, now you're getting into agents and double agents and all the stuff that spy movies are made out of.
Yeah. That's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
So the...
Well, what do you mean that's what you did? You didn't walk into the laboratories. What were you doing?
Well, look at the diary. I visited Albert Hofmann's lab through my father in 1943.
Uh-huh.
So the week that he took the acid. I didn't know that he was taking the acid that week, but it was interesting that April 19th, I think, is the day he did it.
But that was just a synchrony that happened?
Yeah, it was kind of synchronicity. I mean, we were interested in what he was doing there because Sandoz knew what he was trying to develop.
Mm-hmm.
That had been set up in the 30s, but he didn't really make the breakthrough of what he had made till he went for the famous bike ride, right?
Mm.
You know about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the point is that you look at my diary, we visited him that week.
Mm.
My father took me along.
Right.
And I was only 19 years old, but let me see, 21, 1943. But the thing is that we would go around, and we had access to all kinds of things, because we had been, I represent, the solar government represented the wealthiest people in the world. And remember, money as an environment became public property in the 30s, and therefore it was no longer the wealthiest people in the world running the show. But the wealthiest people were still there on the sidelines trying to keep on top of things on the HCE level, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to look at this. The planet's getting smaller and smaller, and it's actually, from the solar government's point of view, not looking at nations. They had no control over that. But they were looking at little labs. There might have been only three in the world that were important. Little labs popping up around the planet, and you could find out where they were because it was a shrunken planet in terms of the information speed up.
Yeah. This wasn't all being orchestrated by one central figure, one man or woman.
Well, we did have the chairperson. We call him chairperson now, but back then it was chairman. There was a chairman of Council 10, but he was just the guy representing the committee. But it
still required the cooperation of all the members.
That's right.
You all had to agree to be on the same team with no dissension and no self-interest other than the interest of the team.
There were factions. But everybody knew what they were doing, and it's just exactly like they present the commission for the mafia. You got different families that have their fights, hit the mattresses against each other occasionally, but when they got to organize themselves in relation to all the other tribes and clans and nations, they get together and have a meeting.
Oh, okay.
And having a chairperson, a chairman, is the Western dynamic of an individual leader. So, of course, you had a leader, but his job by the 50s was to coordinate the factions, like any corporation.
Would that be a name that people would recognize, that chairman?
No, they wouldn't recognize the name.
No.
I'm the only one who's ever gone public with a name and said that I was chairman of Secret Council 10.
Well, potentially, how many people were within this Secret Council that could have gone public if it wasn't for you?
Nobody. Nobody wanted to go public. I went public because I knew it was obsolete.
Yeah, because it was over.
Yeah, it was over.
I just wanted to report the history of what had happened.
Yeah, that's what I was doing in terms of the radio show through Bob Marshall and all that, and still doing that, still explaining what power is today and what it was for the most powerful people and how that power is not there anymore. And this chart is kind of showing that by showing how the machines altered the relations of power among machines, and we're leading up to a later phase of the chart.
Yeah, which is totally outside of the control of human, any Secret Council of 10 or anybody. This thing has its own momentum, and it's going to go its own way, right?
That's pretty close to what it is, but you can, if you're aware of new technologies being made in the labs, like cold ponds and flashing with cold fusion, you can stop that. You can slow down the technological evolution. It's probably inevitable, but you can slow it down.
Yeah.
That's the only input, the 50% input of HCE, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, everybody believes, well, lots of people believe the big oil companies have stomped on all kinds of technology.
Yeah, they probably get all kinds of facts about it, and that's true. Mm-hmm. Now, they can control energy devices, but they can't control the effects of the computer and the Internet and YouTube and all that it does on people.
Yeah.
I mean, oil executives, they have to go around and hide in the underground. Their image is so unpopular,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So you're not the traditional kind of wealthy, powerful person who struts around in public with a big front of pride. You ever met any old executives? You don't see them around, do you?
No.
They ain't strutting their stuff. They have their secret clubs to celebrate themselves. But
the big campaign on by Chevron Oil and these big companies is to convince you through television advertising how eco-friendly they are.
Yeah, and sponsor the Olympics and big art shows and exhibitions and sporting events.
Yeah.
They pretend they're part of the people.
Okay.
I think we've done 45 minutes there.
Yeah, we're ready to take a break.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Okay, bye.